content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religious News Service and The Conversation. First of all, a piece published on the 8th of December by the Religion News Service entitled, Missionary Pilot Ryan Coer Remains in Custody in Mozambique, 6 weeks after arrest, by Bob Smetana. When David Holston first heard that missionary pilot Ryan Coer had been arrested in the city of Inhambane in southern Mozambique in early November, he was concerned, but not too worried. We thought, oh, he's going to have to spend the night in jail, said Holston, president of Missionary Aviation Fellowship, or MAF, a Christian ministry that has operated in Mozambique since the late 1990s. Let's see what we can do to help him. 6 weeks later, Coer remains in jail with no end to his imprisonment in sight. Government officials have yet to charge the 31-year-old Coer, a pilot for Ambassador Aviation Limited, which partners with MAF, and two South African nationals who were arrested with him. Those officials, say MAF leaders, suspect the three were supporting an Islamic insurgent group in the northern part of the country. Coer had flown to Inhambane in early November to pick up a load of over-the-counter medications, vitamins, and other supplies. The plan was to fly those supplies to orphanages near Montupuz, Mozambique. During a regular security screening, airport officials became suspicious and arrested the three men on November the 4th, before the cargo could be loaded on the chartered flight. The supplies and the plane Coer was piloting were seized. Holston said it is not uncommon for security officials to question pilots about their cargo. In the past, he said, MAF pilots have been detained, but that's usually only been a few hours. Coer's case is something different. Holston said MAF staff, a local attorney, and U.S. Embassy officials have been working with authorities in Mozambique to resolve Coer's situation. But so far, there's been little progress. That surprised Holston and other MAF staffers. He said the missionary group has a good relationship with government officials in Mozambique, where Ambassador Aviation is registered as a commercial airline and follows the same rules as other airlines. The group works mostly with Christian nonprofits and medical and humanitarian groups, providing much-needed transportation, especially in areas where the roads are unsafe or where travel on the ground might take too much time. This is a real head-scratcher for us. We've actually transported the president of Mozambique on our aircraft before, said Holston, whose group works in about three dozen countries. There is no secret to what we're doing, and they've relied on us before. Holston said Coer had flown to a part of the country where MAF doesn't usually operate and believes officials at the Inhambane airport were unfamiliar with MAF's work. MAF has denied any wrongdoing on Coer's part. Holston said the pilot seems to have caught the eye of counterterrorism officials who have more leeway in how they act. That's made it harder to get any written charges against Coer, Holston said, or any clarity about his case. After Coer's arrest, his wife and children were evacuated to the United States. The family had been in Mozambique since 2021. Annabelle Coer told television station KTVB in Nampa, Idaho, that she hopes the family can return to that country. My three-year-old considers it home, she told KTVB. He asked if we can go back. Holston said the charter flight Ryan Coer was piloting was fairly typical for MAF. The group often ferries supplies for Christian groups and follows the same security rules as any other airline. He also said MAF is careful in choosing customers to work with. The group does not transport military personnel or insurgents. Holston said MAF supports efforts of the government to address violence in the northern part of the country. The orphanages where Coer was headed were in the region of Cabo Delgado, where more than 4,000 people have been killed since 2017, according to Christianity Today magazine, which has reported on Coer's case. Close to 1 million people have also been displaced. Pilots from MAF have evacuated people fleeing from the region in the past, said Holston, and has transported supplies for the government's Ministry of Health, along with transporting medical personnel to the region. He said MAF flies in dangerous parts of the world because it is needed there, and because the Christian groups and other non-governmental agency it works with often can't afford to pay for a commercial flight. He said donors cover most of the cost of MAF, including salaries for pilots and the cost of planes, meaning they can charge affordable rates. Yet still, there are risks, which Holston says MAF tries hard to manage. Missionaries have often found themselves drawn into armed conflicts in the past. Soldiers in El Salvador abducted and murdered 4 Catholic missionaries, 3 nuns and 1 laywoman, in December 1980, while the missionaries were driving home from the airport. The government of El Salvador blamed extremists for their deaths as part of a cover-up. American officials who supported military aid to El Salvador described the missionaries as political activists. In 2001, the Peruvian military shot down a plane carrying an American missionary family, believing it was carrying drugs as part of a joint program with the CIA. A missionary named Ronnie Bowers and her infant were killed, while Bowers' husband survived. 16 CIA officers were eventually punished for their role in the case. The U.S. government also once looked at missionaries as potential spies. In the 1940s, the Office of Strategic Services, a predecessor of the CIA, was scrambling to find staff who could help provide intelligence during World War II. Missionaries made good candidates because they were often experts about other countries. Most ended up doing intelligence gathering, said Matthew Avery Sutton, author of Double Crossed, The Missionaries Who Spied for the United States During the Second World War. At least one missionary was caught and executed by Nazis. Groups such as the International Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention, which has more than 3,500 missionaries in 118 countries, know their missionaries can be at risk in war zones and other dangerous situations. That's led them to regularly assess for risk by monitoring State Department public reports and news accounts and keeping in contact with staffers on the ground. The IMB believes fulfilling its mission can require being in dangerous places, but the agency has a take no unnecessary risk approach to ministry, said Julie McGowan, Vice President of Public Relations. There are situations where we may withdraw from a location for a period of time to preserve the potential for long-term ministry or long-term personal relationships with our national partners, she said. Holston said he hopes Coer's situation will be resolved soon. He said MAF realizes government officials are trying to do their jobs in a difficult situation, and MAF wants to stay on good terms with them. Still, he said, he hopes the government will do the right thing and let Coer go. We are praying they will look at the evidence and see that these men were not trying to support insurgents, he said. In fact, to the contrary, they're trying to support those who've been hurt by this insurgency. Now a piece that was originally published by The Conversation, which is an independent nonprofit publisher of commentary and analysis, written by academics and edited by journalists for the general public. It was republished by the Religion News Service on the 9th of December, entitled, Who's Giving American Spiritual Care? As congregational attendance shrinks, it's often chaplains. Written by Wendy Kadge, who is a professor of sociology and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Brandeis University. When Americans picture a chaplain, many of them think of someone like Father Mulcahy, the Irish-American priest who cared for Korean War soldiers in the classic TV show MASH. The reality is much more complex. Today's chaplains are diverse in gender, age, religious background, and sexuality. They serve people from all backgrounds, including those with no affiliation. And their roles may become more significant as more Americans step away from traditional religious congregations. 3 in 10 adults in the United States say they are atheists, agnostics, or nothing in particular. I have spent the past 15 years interviewing, shadowing, and writing about these chaplains, religious professionals who work outside of congregations in healthcare, the military, prisons, higher education, and other institutions. My latest book, Spiritual Care, The Everyday Work of Chaplains, describes who they are, what they do, and how it connects to broader aspects of American religious life. In a recent survey that colleagues and I conducted at Brandeis University in partnership with the polling firm Gallup, we found that a quarter of people in the United States have been assisted, counseled, or visited by a chaplain at some point in their lives. Brief history. In the United States, chaplains have been present in the military since the Revolutionary War, initially all Christians. Jewish leaders began to work as chaplains with the advent of Jewish hospitals in the 19th century. In 1861, at the start of the Civil War, a rabbi named Arnold Fischel lobbied President Abraham Lincoln to let Jewish chaplains serve in the military. Lincoln stretched the phrase in federal legislation that required chaplains to be of some Christian denomination far enough to formally include Jews as chaplains in government positions for the first time. The number of non-Christian chaplains has increased ever since. While rabbis frequently visited Jewish inmates, it was not until 1895 that New York State funded an official Jewish chaplain position in the state prison. Non-Christian chaplains began appearing on college and university campuses in the 1920s. Today, there are campus chaplains from a broad range of religious and spiritual backgrounds, including humanists, who see and emphasize the goodness in all people. They are often able to quickly connect with young people, one-third of whom are not religiously affiliated. Chaplains have become increasingly diverse in other ways as well. Little has been written about chaplains of color, for example, but African-American newspapers suggest that the first black chaplain served in the military, which was segregated until 1948. The work today. Today, chaplains work in a variety of settings. Beyond the military, federal prisons, and veterans centers, they are also present in most healthcare organizations and places as surprising as the Olympics, research stations in Antarctica, airports, and some polling places. In interviews I conducted with chaplains in Greater Boston, all said they work around end-of-life care, and almost all engage with people's big-picture life questions. What one chaplain described to me as people's peripheral vision. The questions hovering just out of sight until a crisis forces them into view. Rather than answering questions, chaplains offer a listening ear. Describing her work in a hospital, one explained her role as creating a bit of a holding space and to validate what a person is feeling and give them some sense of hope or stability in the midst of chaotic times. According to our recent survey on demand for chaplain services, about half of people who connected with a chaplain did so in healthcare settings, including hospices. Respondents said that chaplains listened to them, prayed, offered spiritual or religious guidance, or comforted them in a time of need. He was just so compassionate with my mom and I when we lost my grandfather, and it was a sudden loss, one participant recalled of meeting with the chaplain. I knew then God had sent him there to help me deal with the pain and loss. Another said, we talked for hours, and he truly seemed to understand the path my life had been on. I will never forget his kindness. Others said chaplains helped them negotiate conflict, advocated on their behalf, or directed them to resources. Loss, mental and emotional health, death and dying, and dealing with change were frequent topics of conversation. Respondents described chaplains as compassionate, good listeners, knowledgeable, helpful, and trustworthy. Those who were not religiously affiliated interacted with chaplains in similar ways as those who were not. Religious leadership looking forward. In many churches across the United States, for sale signs have been hammered into the ground as places of worship fail to keep afloat. Attendance and membership have been declining for years, and many congregants who switched to virtual attendance during the pandemic are not coming back in person. As membership in formal religious groups continues to decline, enrollment in theological schools is shifting, with growing numbers of new students and programs focused on chaplaincy, as opposed to more traditional work in a congregation. About a quarter of new students in the Master of Divinity programs at Boston University and Union Theological Seminary in fall 2022 were in a chaplaincy track. That number is closer to three-quarters at Iliff School of Theology and at Emmanuel College in Canada. Chaplains have long provided spiritual support and continue to do so as religious demographics shift. They meet people as they are, where they are, and they will provide more and more spiritual care for the future. Closed churches do not signal the end of religious leadership, but a change in where and how it is provided. Our last article was published by the Religion News Service on the 9th of December, entitled, U.S. Leaders Gather to Discuss Rights of Non-Religious People Across the World, by Alejandra Molina. Religious freedom leaders, including a United States ambassador, commissioner, and elected representative, gathered in Washington, D.C. on December the 8th to shed light on the rights of non-religious people in countries across the globe. The convening was part of the launch of the Freedom of Thought Report by Humanist International, an annual look at how non-religious individuals, comprising atheists, agnostics, humanists, and free thinkers, are treated because of their lack of religion or absence of belief in a God. It was hosted by American Atheist, a civil rights organization that works to achieve religious equality for all Americans. Among those in attendance were U.S. Representative Jared Huffman, a congressman for much of California's Bay Area, U.S. Ambassador at Large Rashad Hussan, with the Office of International Religious Freedom, and Frederick Davey with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. To Nick Fish, president of American Atheist, it was meaningful that the Biden-Harris administration, along with other U.S. leaders and the global human rights community, are recognizing our rights are just as worthy of protection as any other religious or belief groups. Emma Wadsworth Jones, a coordinator for Humanist International, who presented the report, underscored that non-religious people are a distinct category within freedom of religion or belief, who have universal human rights, which include the right to freedom of religion and belief, and to freedom of thought and expression. Discrimination against this community is pervasive, she said. Wadsworth Jones underscored that true secularism is inclusive of all, adding that where secularism is upheld, rights tend to be better respected for all. The report, which is in its 11th year, rates all countries and highlights key countries, where the organization updated the ratings in 2022, and a watch list, which includes countries that Humanist International continues to monitor despite their rating holding steady. Humanist International creates ratings by focusing on global human rights agreements that most affect non-religious people, such as the right to freedom of thought, conscience, religion, or belief, and the right to freedom of expression. Ratings factor in apostasy laws that make it illegal to convert to a religion or declare oneself as non-religious, as well as blasphemy laws that outlaw criticism of protected religions and religious figures and institutions, according to the report. The organization also considers family laws that exclude atheists from getting married, as well as other laws requiring citizens to identify their religion on state identification cards, forbidding citizens from identifying as atheist or non-religious. Discrimination against the non-religious is often caused not by a desire to hurt atheists, but by the desire to help one or more religions, according to the report. The report found that only 4% of the global population live in societies that are truly secular, where there is a clear separation of religious and political authorities that do not discriminate against any religion or belief community. Countries like Afghanistan and Iran, which are on organization's watch list, were found to have grave violations and poor ratings due to state legislation being largely or entirely derived from religious law or by religious authorities. In Iran, the country's morality police have triggered months of protests after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini. The report noted that Iran's government periodically jails and executes dozens of individuals on charges of enmity against God. Although this crime is framed as a religious offense and may be used against humanists and other religious dissenters, it is most often used as punishment for political acts that challenge the regime on the basis that to oppose the theocratic regime is to oppose Allah, the report reads. Just as Humanist International launched the report, the Center for Human Rights announced on December 8 that 23-year-old Moshe Shikari was hung under the charge of enmity against God after he was accused of wounding a paramilitary officer during a protest. In Pakistan, the country's legal environment is notably repressive, Wadsworth Jones said, with oppressive blasphemy laws, impunity for violence on religious grounds, and systematic religious discrimination. When looking at Barbados, while its constitution declares the state to be secular, symbolic trappings of state religion remain, Wadsworth Jones said. The preamble to its constitution, for example, states that the people of Barbados acknowledge the supremacy of God, she said. In France, where secularism is a fundamental principle of the state, Wadsworth Jones noted that strict enforcement of such principles has been criticized for leading to discrimination against religion or belief minorities by limiting their freedom of worship. Discrimination against Muslims in France has increased in recent years, particularly after the 2015 terrorist attacks and during COVID-19, she said. The United States received a relatively good rating due to strong constitutional protections in favor of freedom of thought, religion, or belief. It remains on the watch list, however, because, according to the report, those freedoms, mixed with Christian conservatism and a wealthy Christian right lobby, means that secular, humanist, and civil liberties groups find themselves facing a battle to preserve the inherent secularism of the Constitution. This threat to secularism gained a greater foothold under the presidency and influence of Donald Trump, resulting in the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe and the federal right to an abortion, according to the report. Extremism and religion continue to pose a severe threat to our democracy, said Huffman, who identifies as a humanist, adding that white Christian nationalist groups continue to export their dangerous, violent ideology and to find more traction in the mainstream. My colleagues are feeling more confident and calling out the threat of white Christian nationalism directly, he said. Huffman, who helped establish the Congressional Freethought Caucus, highlighted a bipartisan resolution passed by the House of Representatives last year that condemns heresy, blasphemy, and apostasy laws. He also noted legislation he introduced that would require healthcare sharing ministries to disclose a range of information to federal agencies. Husan, with the Office of International Religious Freedom, spoke about Nigerian humanist and atheist Mubarak Bala, who was sentenced to more than 20 years in prison following accusations that he had committed blasphemy against Islam and Muslims, he said. Bala was arrested in 2020 and formally charged in 2021 for causing a public disturbance by posting blasphemous content. Early this month, the USCIRF called out the U.S. Department of State after it failed to include Nigeria or India in its latest designations of countries of particular concern. Governments do not only weaponize blasphemy laws against humanists and atheists, they use them against Christians, Muslims, and many more, Husan said. The report highlighted that any rights violations and discrimination are important, even when only small numbers of people are affected, adding that the non-religious are not a small group. It cited findings from the 2012 WIN Gallup International Association showing that atheism and the non-religious population have grown rapidly, with religion dropping by 9 percentage points and atheism rising by 3 percentage points between 2005 and 2012. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you'll listen again next time. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. We wish you a very happy new year.